Cavaliers within one. Durant catch and shoot three from the left. Hits it, and he's fouled by J.R. Smith. Kevin Durant a chance at a four-point play. Curry spots up open for three. Straight down, six-point game. And the outlet is stolen, Hubie. They tried to get Kyrie Irving. Three-quarter court down. The other way, it's Curry. Curry against James. Baseline right, cut off by LeBron. Circles in, goes out, has him on skates. Takes James to the rim, and he scores! What a move! Karim goes off to the corner. LeBron let it go, and it's Iguodala coming up with it. Over to Durant, a wide-open triple bricked. Pass is tipped out to Klay Thompson, who reloads a three and hits. How many opportunities will the Warriors get? A long lob batted away by Curry down low defensively. Down court, Durant at the rim. Fouled, and he scored. Curry gets a screen. Passes out left side to Thompson. Barely made it there. Picks it up. Shoots a three and hits. Love outside the mid-post left. Backing down Durant. Now clear space. Blocked by Durant. And his fifth, and he takes it away. Here's Durant crossing over James, driving into Love. Puts it off the window and in as he hits the deck. What a game for Kevin Durant. Kevin Durant dribbling just inside of half court, guarded by LeBron James. West sets a screen, now chasing down. Durant for three, hits it again. James couldn't get there fast enough. He's got 31. Curry on the weak side has the rebound and a triple-double. The first of his postseason career. And he strokes a three, and he hits it. Steph Curry with 30 points. Warriors lead by 22.
Usually you're a podium guy. I mean, in the finals especially, is just coming doing this in the locker room any reason for that?
There is a reason.
You want to share?
No. It has nothing to do with wins and losses, though.
LeBron, you just feel it's a case where you guys just need to defend home court at this point?
Are you a smart guy?
I think so. Sure.
I think so, right? So if we don't defend home court, what happens?
But yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying.
I'm asking you.
Well, yeah. You guys are looking at getting swept.
All right. The answer to your question. They're a different team. You guys asked me what was the difference, and I told you so. Different team.
Down 0-2, you know, going back home, you know, you got to live with those odds, and you got to remain non-wavering, as I say, never wavering in terms of whatever the outlook looks like. We go home, we understand who we are, and then we stay the course. As much as the comparison wants to be drawn from last year, this year, this is a totally different team. There is no comparison, even though being down 0-2 again, going back home. So it's a different series, I mean, from our third year that we're playing against one another. You know, going back home, still got to still stay the course.
We have to do the little things to withstand their runs that they're gonna make, because they're a very talented team. They have two top class players in this league. You got to expect them to shoot better just naturally being at home. So we have to do the little things, not turn the ball over and continue to keep them off the offensive glass, do our best job keeping them off the free throw line.
They came on through a nice blow to start the game, getting to the paint, you know, and I think that's one thing we got to cover. I mean, we can't give up 23 points off our turnovers. You know, that's especially a championship team like that. They're going to thrive off of it. But I just think we just stay poised and, you know, try to play better one-on-one defense and, you know, make them shoot over a contest, and they're going to make some. But if we just try to make it tough on them, it'll be in our favor. We know how hard it is to be the best team in the league. So we got to just keep going, man, keep our foot on the gas and keep getting better every day.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yeah. Did that reporter actually ask LeBron James if he feels like they really have to go home and defend the home court now? Did he really just ask that question? Did he really just say, when you're down 0-2 in a best-of-seven series and the next two games are in your home building, did he really just say, do you feel like you really need to defend your home court now? Or something of that nature? Did he really say that? Tell me he didn't say that. Tell me that was not an actual question. Jim Cushlin, Frank Gargano, can you confirm or deny for me whether or not that reporter asked that question?
He did ask that question.
And can you replay the question and the answer, please? Because I can't believe that actually happened. And if it did, I cannot believe and do not want to believe that this guy still has a job. How do you ask that question? You're down 0-2. If you lose either of the next two, if you lose the next two, which are on the home court, the series is over. Do you feel like now you have to go home and protect your home court? He didn't really ask that question. He couldn't have. And if he did, let me hear it.
LeBron, you just feel it's a case where you guys just need to defend home court at this point?
Are you a smart guy?
I think so. Sure.
I think so, right? So if we don't defend home court, what happens?
But yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying.
I'm asking you.
Well, yeah, then you guys are looking at getting swept.
All right. That answers your question.
Somebody today on Twitter, I can't remember who, but somebody today I saw paraphrase that and said that would be like asking, would you consider either one of the next two games must wins? Well, not if we don't want to get swept, or not unless we don't want to get swept. I mean, honestly, that question just kind of typified, I guess, the night for the Cleveland Cavaliers and for LeBron James, who would not come out to the podium and speak with the press, who would not come out and answer questions in the normal interview room that goes with postseason basketball, playoffs, and NBA Finals. LeBron James, who is averaging in two games in the finals, 28.5 points, 13 rebounds, and 11 assists, and is down 0-2 by a lot to a better team. LeBron James did not come out and face the reporters. He did invite them into the locker room, kind of, sort of, in a very, very much more informal locker room gang interview, gather around his locker. But he did not want to come out, and I guess that's there's so many different ways and so many different elements of this that we want to break down. And I think it's time to really start acknowledging what I said last week. Not that I'm the only one. I'm not trying to say that I'm sort of a prescient basketball analyst here, but a lot of people talk about it too. But the Cavaliers are probably. No, not probably. The Cavaliers are the second best basketball team in the world. And there's no shame in that. But the truth of the matter is that the best basketball team in the world is a lot better than they are. The gap between one and two is vast. It is large. The Cavaliers have some really, really good players. And they have done some really, really great things. The Golden State Warriors are just a better basketball team. They're much better. And not necessarily because of their individual brilliance, but because of the way they play and because of the way they approach the game with one another, because of the chemistry, because of the fluidity with which they play the game. And that's something I think we saw on display last night. In game number two of the finals, as I welcome you to the extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, Bob France with you. Jim Cushlin and Frank Argano are here. And we're going to break this down. Dennis Manloff is going to be with us to break this down, too, at about 3:35. We want you to talk about it with us as well if you are ready and able and willing. But the bottom line is we talked about this on Friday's show, I think it was, and we went man by man, position by position. Point guard, shooting guard, small forward, power forward, center, bench. And we determined that it's pretty damn near a wash. If there is a slight edge for the Warriors, it is just that slight. We gave the Warriors the edge, or excuse me, we gave the Cavaliers the edge at the small forward position, which is LeBron over KD. Although that is not coming out coming out in the wash. It's not turning out that way. At least in this series. I just mentioned LeBron James is averaging 28.5, 13, and 11 in two games, and he's being outplayed by Kevin Durant in the process, which is impossible to think about, but it's true. But we gave a slight edge to the Cavaliers at the small forward position. We gave him a slight edge at the center position, Thompson over Pachulia. We gave the Warriors a slight edge it's actually a pretty large edge in the shooting guard position. Klay Thompson versus what has been a non-existent J.R. Smith, which we'll get to, by the way. We gave them the slight edge at power forward with Draymond Green only because of the way he plays with them over Kevin Love. Kevin Love has been a man, by the way, in this finals. And then we called the point guard battle between Kyrie and Steph Curry even. And we called the bench even. So, in other words, it's just it really is neck and neck on an individual basis. But when you look at the way they play together and the way they run their offense and the way they attack in waves, it's not an individual thing where it's a series of one-on-one battles. It's one fluid machine against a much more clunky, kind of point A to point B to point C type of an attack that the Cavaliers have. And when the points change all of the time, they look disjointed and out of sorts. Let's break down what happened in Game 2 of the NBA Finals and talk about how improbable, if not impossible, it is that the Warriors won Game 2 by more than they won Game 1. Or actually, no, they didn't, because it was 22, right? 22 was the margin in Game 1. It was 19 this time around.
Right, yeah.
Okay, sorry about that. Because of garbage time at the end there, it really, you know, that kind of thing changed. But at any rate, in Game 1, or after Game 1, those who cared were trying to figure out how it was a 22-point game. And we started looking at some of the numbers, and the numbers that are inside the numbers that we came up with were, well, for one thing, the Warriors turned the ball over only 4 times in Game 1. Cavaliers turned it over 20 times. That's a major, major problem. 20 turnovers to 4. The assists as well. Because the Warriors had 31 assists to go with those 4 turnovers. Cavaliers had just 15 assists to go along with their 20 turnovers. Game, set, match. There you go. You could just kind of, you could lock it in right there and say that is the biggest problem. That is the biggest difference between the winning team and the losing team. Well, so this time around, the Cavaliers turned that around completely. They went from 20 turnovers down to 9. They went from 15 assists up to 27. A 15 to 20 assist to turnover ratio becomes 27 to 9. The Warriors, who had just 4 turnovers, ballooned to 20, like the Cavaliers made, 8 of them belonging to Steph Curry. They still passed the ball extraordinarily well and had 34 more assists, but 20 turnovers. So Golden State goes from 4 to 20. Cleveland goes from 20 to 9 in the turnover department. And Golden State still blows them out in a game that was never really in doubt. Even at halftime, when the Cavaliers hit a late bucket by Kyrie, I believe it was, to pull within, what was it, 2 or 3 at the half? I think it was three.
67-64.
So it was 2. Thank you. Appreciate it. So they pull, 67-64?
Yeah.
Or 6?
67-64 was the 3-point game.
Okay, I thought you said 66-64. Okay. So even then, I didn't feel like, okay, the Cavaliers have got control of this. Not even for a second did I think Golden State was out of control, even as the score started to, pinch a little bit there toward the end of the first half. And then we all know what happened in the second half, and they came out and just took total control, outscored the Cavaliers by 11 in the third. Gives him a 14-point lead going into the fourth, and that was all she wrote. It's all they really needed. But when you turn the other team over 20 times, and they only turn you over 9 times, and they score more points off of their turnovers, there are 9 that they forced than you do off of the 20 that you forced, that is a problem. I mean, what more, if you're the Cavaliers, can you do? Let me rephrase. There are a lot of things that the Cavaliers individually can do. As a team, I don't know what more you can ask them to do against this Golden State Warriors juggernaut. I talked about this last week, how I didn't think the Cavaliers were necessarily going to be super competitive in this series, because Golden State is just that good. And the Kevin Durant factor is just that important. I talked about it, and it's coming. I mean, it's being played out right before our very eyes. They are that good. He is that much of a difference maker. And no matter what the Cavaliers do, I don't think they can close that gap. But having said that, I did say that there are some individuals who can do a lot more. And sure enough, somebody needs to explain to me where J.R. Smith is. Somebody needs to tell me how the Cavaliers starting shooting guard, who was a playoff assassin 1 year ago, can start again yesterday, play 14 minutes only, and go scoreless in the basketball game. Scoreless! Without an assist either. It's not like he's passing up shots to make better passes for layups. Scoreless. Took two shots. J.R. Smith is not the J.R. Smith that we knew from a year ago. And how incredibly inconvenient it is that he is not the J.R. Smith that we knew from a year ago after he signed an off-season, multi-year, massive dollar contract extension in which the Cavaliers were bidding against themselves because there wasn't even a market for J.R. Smith in the off-season. How long did he sit there as a free agent? Not signing somebody else's offer sheet, just nothing happening. But the Cavaliers not willing to pay him everything that he wanted. Pretty soon, here comes LeBron, pay the man. Dan Gilbert says, all right, I'll pay the man. And here we sit. What happened? There's another guy that got paid relatively recently, this time two summers ago. Very, very important. Huge contributor to the Cavaliers' postseason success in this playoff. From Indiana to Toronto to Boston, but now here against the Golden State Warriors, Tristan Thompson, the starting center, played only 21 minutes in the game, grabbed a grand total of 4 rebounds. This is a 9, 10, 11, 12 rebound a night guy. This is a 4, 5, 6 offensive rebound a night guy. 4 rebounds. 8 points, 4 rebounds for Tristan Thompson. The bench, practically invisible. Practically invisible. Channing Frye finally found some time. Went 1-for-5 shooting at 2 points. Darren Williams got an opportunity. He was supposed to be the big upgrade for the Cavaliers behind Kyrie Irving. 0-for-5, 0-for-2 from 3. Did not score in his time on the floor in 14 minutes. Iman Shumpert cannot shoot. 1-for-6. He did make all 4 free throws. So he had 6 points, 4 rebounds, and 3 steals. Kyle Korver, the sharpshooting acquisition, finally made 1 after making none in game 1. He was 1-for-3. That makes him 1-for-6 in the two NBA Finals games. There are individuals who quite simply are either in over their heads or they're completely, I hate the word psyched out. It just sounds too casual and too juvenile. But mentally they are defeated. How about that? That mentally, psychologically, they're defeated. They're just not giving what they have to give. And while all of that's going on with the Cavaliers, the Warriors are now clicking on all cylinders. And I emphasize the word all because of the production they're getting from their bench and because of the production they're now getting from the second of the two Splash Brothers. I warned about this after game 1 on Friday about how Klay Thompson, once he gets going, it's going to be all over. Kevin Durant and Steph Curry can carry them anyway. But if Klay Thompson gets hot, forget about it. Guess what? Klay Thompson got hot. And you can forget about it. 8-for-12 overall, 4-for-7 from deep, along with 7 rebounds, and an assist. And again, some of the great defense on Kyrie Irving. They are clicking on all cylinders. But the most important cylinder wasn't Steph Curry. Steph Curry did have that amazing single-handed dribbling breakdown of LeBron James in the, was that early in the third, guys?
I know it was second half.
Okay, I believe it was early in the third, and yeah. it was when they really kind of started to pull away, and the building went crazy, despite the double dribble, and he did double dribble in that possession. For those who have not seen it, it is viral. He double dribbled, but he went in with the ball from the right wing against LeBron, who decided, I'm going to get one of those stops right now against Steph Curry. You're not scoring. LeBron was all over him, and Curry took him in. Curry took him left. Curry took him right. Curry took him back outside the three-point arc. Curry stutter-stepped in. Curry can't hit back outside the three-point arc. That's at the point where he looked like he was going to square up and shoot, and LeBron started to go up to block it, And then, of course, he pulled himself back down, went right around LeBron, and drove in and scored on the driving layup. It was a remarkable, remarkable play by Curry, aided by the double dribble. I'm not talking about a carry, by the way. Carries we see all the time, stars doing, you know, some amazing things with the basketball, but of course they're stopping and starting by carrying, putting their hand under the ball and then turning it over again and again. This wasn't that. This was a flat out double dribble. This was a, he put the ball in two hands and then re-dribbled, started over again. It's when he tried to square up and make it look like he was going from deep. He should have gotten called for that, but he didn't. Curry did some amazing things, but the bottom line here is Kevin Durant is on the kind of mission that I assumed he would be. Kevin Durant isn't coattail riding his way to a ring. Kevin Durant isn't just along for the ride on the Warriors championship bus. Kevin Durant came to Oakland, California from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, and got in the bus driver's seat. It's his team. He is dominating this series. He's dominating LeBron James, and he's going to have a ring that he can be proud of as opposed to one that he should be ashamed to put on. It's exactly what I feared would happen, and it's happening right now. Going to get out here. I got a lot more stuff to say. I got a lot more things to ask. I've got a lot of things I want to hear from Cushlin and Gargano about. I want to hear from you as well at 866-240-1065. But I want to get out now to make some room for our friend Dennis Mandeloff, who joins us next.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed. Rolling onward, it's 3:35. Thanks for joining us on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader, breaking down game number two of the NBA Finals. Really kind of a composite, I suppose, of both of the first two games is what we're doing here, looking at the gap between the best team in basketball, which is very, very plain to see, and the second best team in basketball. It is not a very small gap. Joining us now to discuss is Mr. Dennis Mandeloff, who covers the Cavaliers and more out of Cleveland for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. D-Man, how you doing, brother?
Bob, you know what my dad used to say? He used to say, when you're beat, you're beat. Admit it, and that's it.
Yeah. And you know, Dennis, it's what's really strange is there's a part of me, and you and I chatted before we came on the air today, obviously. There's a part of me that, as I said to you before, is fully willing to concede that one team is just much better than the other, that the gap between one and two is a vast one, and I'm okay with that. You can't pass blame and say, well, these guys did something wrong here, they're underperforming or whatever. That's what part of me wants to say, but Dennis, the other part of me wants to look at J.R. Smith, who took two shots, and look at Tristan Thompson, who grabbed four rebounds, and look at the bench players who were so vital to the Cavaliers getting there, especially the way they played in the postseason in the first three rounds, and look at the lack of production from Korver and Deron Williams and Fry and on down the line, and say, you know, these guys aren't playing their best. Part of me wonders how, and let me ask you, Dennis, that'll be my first real big question for you, is if those individuals I just mentioned were playing at their best level, at the same time that LeBron and Kevin Love are playing at really, really high levels, Kyrie, for the most part, a high level, not quite as, but if they were all playing their very best, and then they were still getting smacked around by Golden State, you really wouldn't have anything to say, but you do have to wonder about why some of these guys are no-showing in the first two games.
Yeah, but Bob, I prefer to look at it as Golden State is making the Cavaliers look bad, all right? I think it's 85% to 90%. Golden State making the Cavs look bad, then the Cavs underperforming, you know, in a vacuum, if you will. I mean, because I'm obviously here in Cleveland, you read stuff, oh, well, the Cavs need to do this better, that better, this better, that better. Well, the problem is they're running into, in my mind, one of the greatest teams I've seen assembled in a long, long time. They have an incredible offense, very diversified, very versatile. They can hurt you in so many ways. And, oh, by the way, they have this spectacular defense. They have incredible length. I mean, it's a lethal combination, the perfect storm too, because they were super, super hot coming into the playoffs, and they have Durant, so, and they're healthy, so everything that possibly could go right for Golden State, and they breezed through the first two rounds. They weren't worn down a little bit by a series like they were last year against Oak City. So when I looked at it going into the postseason, I thought Golden State could go 14-0. I thought the one place that they could stumble was game three against the Eastern Conference representative in the NBA Finals on the road. And here we are, 14-0.
Yeah, you were right. You hit that right on the head. They swept through, and obviously I don't think they would have had it not been for Zaza's size 18s underneath Kawhi Leonard. I think the Spurs win that game. They were up 23 at the time. And then, of course, we know that they came back with Kawhi out. It was just so deflating for San Antonio. But it did work out the way it did, and they are 14-0. And now the question is whether or not this will end at 16-0. But before we talk about that, I get what you're saying about the Warriors making the Cavaliers look bad, but do the Warriors make J.R. Smith only want to take two shots? He only took three, I think, in the first game, two this game. I mean, if anything, their run-and-gun style, which the Cavaliers have been trying to match, and we'll talk styles in a moment, too, they've been trying to match the, hey, we'll stroke three for three with you, we'll run with you, and so on. We'll play your game and try to beat you. If anything, that would lend itself to JR's gunslinger mentality. He's just not interested. So is that a Golden State thing, Dennis? Or is there something else going on there that makes a guy like J.R. Smith suddenly shy about pulling the trigger?
Bob, I wouldn't say he's not interested. What I'd say to that, to your point, is you're not going to get right when you play Golden State. And the fact of the matter is J.R. Smith has had a very uneven season, certainly in the regular season, had personal things to deal with that I can't even imagine. And thank God, you know, for the health of his child now. But he had an incredible personal issue that he was dealing with. So I forgave him any issues that he might have had during the regular season. But the fact is, entering the playoffs, he wasn't the J.R. Smith of last season. And he really didn't set the world on fire in the playoffs either, heading into these finals. So the point being is that, yeah, I get what you're saying about J.R. maybe not having everything taken away from him by Golden State. But if you're in a slump, if you're having a rough season and a rough postseason, you're not going to suddenly start making shots against Golden State.
What about Tristan Thompson, Dennis? What is Golden State doing to him to limit his effectiveness? We know how incredible he was last year in the finals to help beat them and how great he was in the playoffs this year in the first three rounds to get here. What are they doing to, limit his effectiveness? He creates so many second and third chance opportunities for the Cavs on the offensive glass that is just backbreaking to defenses. And my goodness, four rebounds yesterday. And what did he have, two or three in game one? What are they doing to Tristan, or is there something going on with him?
Oh, they're staying connected to him. They're keeping a body at him. It's easier said than done with a lot of teams, but Golden State's able to do it. And listen, here's the problem, Bob. When Tristan Thompson is not helping you on the boards and he's not doing the dirty work, he's virtually useless, okay, because he can't do anything offensively other than garbage points. And every time the Cavs go down the floor, I mean, sometimes you wonder, okay, why does the ball get stuck in? Of course, the blame will go when the ball gets stuck with the Cavs. Oh, it's Kyrie and LeBron, too much one-on-one. Well, if you were Kyrie and LeBron and you were going down the floor facing a great defense and you were 4-on-5 every single time when Thompson's on the floor, you know, it's easier for the ball to get stuck. And you have to do more one-on-one because you can't run anything through Tristan Thompson. You can't even pass him the ball at the high post or the low post. And then he passes it somewhere because he's so inept offensively. So when he's not doing anything defensively and he's not rebounding, he's useless. As a result, I would pull the plug on Thompson. I'm sorry. I mean, I know that looks like a panic move, but you're down 2-0. You're getting trounced both times. I'd put Derek Williams in there and take my chances. I don't care. I mean, I'd rather see Derek Williams out there. You can't tell me that Derek Williams, as rusty as he is, and I'm not saying he's an all-star, okay? But you can't tell me he won't get 8 or 9 rebounds with his energy, and at least he can threaten you offensively, unlike Thompson.
Dennis Manteloff joining us from Cleveland, breaking down the NBA Finals now. Cavaliers find themselves down 0-2 to the Warriors for the second straight year. Dennis, you told me earlier today, you know, and you're right, sometimes you got to stop looking for the blame on your own side and just tip the cap to the other guys and acknowledge their greatness. and you're ready to do that. I am certainly willing to do that. To that end, let's talk about Kevin Durant and Steph Curry, and we'll start with Durant. I said going into this finals, when I asked you the question, too, about who's got more pressure on them, LeBron or Durant, LeBron because he's fighting for GOAT status and he has to win another ring, and to beat these guys would go a long way to it. Durant because he's fighting for all-time status, he needs his first ring. But he can't just coattail ride. He can't just be on the bus. He's got to drive the bus. And through two games, well, let's just say this. LeBron James, his counterpart at the three, is averaging 28.5, 13 rebounds, and 11 assists in this series, and Durant is outplaying him. That is the best compliment I think you can possibly pay to this guy based on what he has done through two games.
There's no question about it. I mean, Kevin Durant has done a fantastic job. He's obviously not nervous. You know, maybe he was nervous for the first 2 minutes of game one, but other than that, he's been just fine. He's terrific. And, you know, it makes me think, Bob, I wish, when you talk about the trilogy, I wish it would have been, you know, fully healthy Warriors from last year versus fully healthy Cavaliers from, you know, because when you add Durant, he's such a difference maker that it's almost, you know, okay, well, the Warriors avenged last year's NBA Finals loss. Yeah, sort of, but they added an all-world player, you know, that's they were entitled to do it.
It would be like Ali facing Frazier for the third time with horseshoes in his mitts, you know?
Yeah.
We're going to show this once and for all, and look what I've added this time around. I mean, you're right. It changes the entire complexion.
Curry gets to crow. He gets to be, you know, cocky and everything. That's great. But it helps to have Durant next to you when you're doing that. So, again, no excuses for the Cavaliers. I mean, you play the team that's in front of you, and this team happens to be awesome, and it's a mismatch. It'll be amazing to me if it gets beyond five games. I mean, that would be a miraculous achievement by the Cavs. I don't think it'll go any more than five. I'd probably put it at 50-50 that it's a sweep. It all depends, really, I think, on the first half of Game 3. If the Warriors lead at the end of the half of Game 3, I think the Cavaliers are going to be like, okay, we have absolutely zero chance of winning a game. But, you know, maybe the Cavs steal Game 3, but I don't think they get Game 4, and then it goes to Golden State for 5. So bottom line is you acknowledge them. You don't quit. You don't quit. You compete. You know, that's what we tell our kids. Keep fighting, keep competing, and, you know, the thing about it is the Warriors are fantastic. They just are. You have to acknowledge it.
Kyrie was asked after the game about, you're down 0-2, but you were down 0-2 last year as well. Very similar circumstances. Last year outscored by 48, I think, in the first two games at Golden State. This year outscored by 41 in the first two games. So, you know, you can still do this kind of a thing. And Kyrie's response, I won't quote him, I'll paraphrase him, was totally different team. And I don't know if he meant his own or theirs. If they followed up, and he said maybe both. But certainly he said totally different team, that coming back on these guys and beating them 4 out of 5 times is going to be next to impossible.
Absolutely. And I think you've got a degree of defeatism in the Cavaliers right now. They know it. They see what's in front of them, and they could do the math. They recognize that even their best basketball is probably not going to be enough. Even if the Cavs are playing fantastic ball, they probably still won't beat them. And to ask any team to play fantastic against the Warriors is very, very, it's an incredibly tall order. But yeah, the big difference between last year and this year, of course, is Durant. But also, I will give you that Curry was banged up. It's not an excuse. You don't put an asterisk by the Cavs title. But I think Curry was banged up. The Thunder series took something out of him. And he wasn't nearly as agile, hostile, and mobile as he's been in the first two games of this series. So when you add Durant and a healthy Curry, that's an enormous, enormous difference between this year and last year.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that makes Curry more effective this year is the presence of Durant, not just the health or anything else, because I'm tired of that argument. Everybody they've played for the last 3 years in the postseason has been banged up way more than they are. So he's got a little nick last year in the finals. Too bad. He played. That's it. But the point being, Durant's presence has made him even more open, has given him even more, you know, windows of opportunity to do special things. And whether it's pulling up in transition and hitting threes from 30, or whether it's, you know, going to the basket and making people look silly the way he did to LeBron on that in-and-out move. He went down inside to the paint, came back out to the three-point line. Double dribbled, by the way, that the referees did not catch. Double dribbled plainly when he faked, like, the spot-up three before he was able to get LeBron up. As Austin Carr would say, get him a bird, and then went by him for the layup. But, you know, it really is a lot easier for Steph Curry this time around because of the presence of Kevin Durant.
Sure it is. And you know what, Bob, as you look at the Warriors, you realize, too, that if one of the big guys has an off night, there's plenty of areas where they can, you know, get points. Look at last night. Look at Klay Thompson last night. I mean, Klay Thompson been in a shooting slump for I don't know how long. All of a sudden, he's, what, 8 of 12 from the field, gets 20-some points, 21 points. I mean, they're so deep, and they're so versatile. They can score inside, outside. They run you to death. If you want to play Globetrotters with them and ABA with them, they can do that. They gladly will do that. They'll score 130 to your 120. If you want to get grimy with them, they can do that because they're the best defensive team in the NBA. They can rebound because they're so active and so long. They can shut the wings off. They can, you know, shut your water off on the three-pointers. So it is an incredibly daunting task that any team would face. And that's why, you know, when Cleveland loses this series, I'm not going to sit here and criticize the Cavaliers. I mean, I'm not. This is not a team, you know, a matchup where you said, okay, the Cavs should win this series. All right, or the Cavs are even in this series. No, this is a team. They're playing a super team. They're playing one of the all-time greats. If Durant had not been injured this regular season, who knows how many regular season victories they would have had. You know, as it stands, they had 67. So who knows? But, I mean, This is an all-time great team that the Cavaliers are facing.
Let's talk styles, Dennis Manilov. It appears through two games that Ty Lue said we're built to run and gun with anybody. You know, that's why we got Cole.
No, you're not.
That's kind of what they've done in the postseason run that was 12-1 up to this point. They're draining threes at, you know, to the, you know, 18, 19, 20 a game. They're out there just, you know, spreading the ball and splashing from everywhere. Defenses are scrambling to keep up in the same way that Golden State does. And so they're playing that style. Is it time for the Cavaliers to go back to what a lot of people not so politely refer to as the slow, grinded out, stanky leg offense and take some possessions away from Golden State? Use more shot clock. Don't get in that kind of a, you know, that running match with them where you're trying to trade threes and trade fast break opportunities?
Yes, yes, yes. 1,000 times yes, Bob. When you look back at the games that the Cavaliers have had success against the Warriors in the past few years. And granted, again, most of them without Durant being on the Warriors. But when you look at the way they've beaten them, most of the time, it has been not super low-scoring games, but lower-scoring games. Okay, look at last year's finals. What was it, 93-89?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the only chance you have against the Warriors. You're not going to run and gun with those guys. You just aren't. Especially this crew. This group, as healthy as it is, as fresh as it is, as hungry as it is, you cannot compete with them in a track meet. All right? You're going to have to slow it down. Now, the problem is, when you're at home, what's the tendency, Bob? Well, what do you want to do at home? You don't want to play the grimy game. You want to show off. You want to be running. You say, okay, we can run with you guys.
You want to get the fans excited with fastball. Yeah, you're right. Right.
Yeah, we're feeling emboldened, and we're going to run you out of our gym, and we're going to show you, because it's a mano a mano thing. You know, it's an ego thing. But the problem is, if you do that, the Warriors are going to beat you on the road just like they beat you at home. So you have to you have to be disciplined in your offense. I know that some would say, well, when you run the slowdown game, that plays into Golden State's hands because they get a chance to get set up and their length is even more effective. I disagree. I think if you run your plays the way you should, if you isolate when you need to, if you move the ball the way you should, you can get a shot at some point in the shot clock that is a good one. And as a result, yes, you need, I think you need to play a slower pace in order to have any chance to make this competitive.
Dennis, I want to ask you about Jeff Van Gundy last night. Let's play the clip real quick here. This is what Van Gundy said about whom the Cavaliers are facing in this NBA Finals.
One of the best duos to play together, maybe ever. Kevin Durant coming off the pick and roll. That's just unguardable. And Steph Curry. Yeah, I said it. The best to play ever together.
One of the best duos to play together ever. They've played two games in these NBA Finals. I think it's a little heady. I think you start talking sure. about Kobe and Shaq and Michael and Scottie and Kareem and Magic. I mean, you could go on. Moses and Doc. It's a lot of to say something like that is awfully heady after two games of an NBA Finals and zero rings together thus far. What did you take away from that comment?
Yeah, that's what I would say to Van Gundy. Slow your roll, dude. Just hold on a second here. I mean, to me, the best duo I've ever seen in my lifetime of watching professional basketball was Michael and Scottie. I mean, I thought they were spectacular together. You know, and Pippen was a great Robin to Jordan Fat Man. So that's my number one. And Shaq and Kobe was number two. You have to go a long way. Okay, as a duo, Steph and Kevin, to catch Michael and Scottie and Shaq and Kobe. So give me, you know, pile up a few rings first before I'll entertain that thought.
Yeah, and I get his point. His point is to just talk about how great they are, not what their career accomplishments have been, but especially how well they play together and the way they're feeding off one another. And it's hard to argue that. Even LeBron, like I said, LeBron is having a great series thus far, even though he had the eight turnovers in game one, which is not acceptable at all. But he is averaging, as I mentioned, 28.5, 13 boards and 11 assists through the two games, and it means nothing. It's meant nothing. Kevin Love has carried the weight. Kevin Love played an outstanding game in Game 2. He was solid, even though his shooting percentage wasn't high. He had 21 rebounds in Game 1 to go along with 15 points. So it's not like LeBron is totally, quote, alone, you know, the way he was in the 07 series against the Spurs. But, you know, even LeBron playing at his peak level and some other guys doing some things, you know, Kevin Durant's out playing him. And the Warriors are just that much better than the Cavaliers on the whole.
Yeah, Bob, and that's why I've said, you know, I'm not counting this loss against LeBron's legacy. I just won't. You know, I look at NBA Finals as bonus material. Obviously, rings help the legacy, but I'm not going to hurt you if you lose in finals, if your team loses in finals. Because you look at the NBA Finals that LeBron will have lost, it's going to be five. And at least three of them, I mean, there's no way I'm holding him accountable for the first one. I'm not holding him accountable for 2 years ago when he was all by himself against the Warriors. And I'm not holding him accountable for this one either. So, you know, it's laziness. It's low-hanging fruit to sit here and go, wow, LeBron's going to be 3-5 in the finals. That hurts his legacy.
Well, let me challenge you on one of those, and that one being this one. For as great as they are, the Warriors, that is, as we're talking about, LeBron isn't surrounded by, you know, a bunch of garbage the way he was with Eric Snow and Larry Hughes and the boys in 07. I mean, this is the second best team in basketball. He's got great players around him. He's got all-stars in Love and in Irving. You know, and he's got the role players to fill in around them, as well as a lot of the legends that you and I talk about have ever had around them. It's one thing to say, I'm disappointed he didn't win it, versus, quote, holding it against him. I mean, this is on the record. You know, Magic lost to Bird, and Bird lost to Magic, and they've got to own those. You can't just say, well, they were playing better teams than they were that year, so it doesn't count. the loss counts too, especially when this team has been built in the image that you yourself, when I say you, I mean LeBron, kind of wanted. Because he told Dan Gilbert, pay Tristan, pay JR, go get me another shooter. I need a better backup point guard. And they filled all of those wishes, and here we sit. So at what point are you not able to say, hey, you know, this counts. This counts as a loss on your record in the finals.
Well, of course it counts.
But I mean, counts in more so than the 07 did, or the injury plagued team 2 years ago, that sort of thing.
What I'm saying is that, in all likelihood, LeBron's going to have a really good series, and the Cavaliers are going to get bounced in four or five games, all right? Therefore, how do I sit there and go, you know what, LeBron, you got to shoulder blame for this loss. I'm not going to do it. That's all.
Okay, and that's fair enough. I certainly the 07 one is a different thing. And the injury problem that they had 2 years ago is a totally different thing as well. But they're healthy now, and they're good. They're healthy, and they're good, and it's a loaded team, but it's just run into a better loaded team. And to me, that's just the way things work. And, you know, Tim Duncan didn't win every finals he was ever in either. He won five of them, but he lost some, too. And guess what? You know, those count. Those count on the record, and you shouldered all right. The L there as much as anything. So that's where I came from on that one. So if you had to put money on it, and I know you don't bet, Dennis, but is it four, or do they get one of these two and go back to San Antonio?
I told you earlier, I thought 50-50 chance they win game three, but no more than five. I would say the way Golden State's playing right now, the mission that they're on, as healthy as they are, as hot as they are, I'll say it's a sweep.
I sadly agree with you. I said at the start of this thing, Cavaliers in six. Warriors in
six. I'll say this, Bob. If Golden State gets three, they're going to walk to game four because the Cavs are completely going to pack it in at that point.
Oh, yeah. Emotionally, oh, yeah. They'll be done. There's no question about it. Dennis Manilov, always outstanding analysis, my friend. We'll talk to you again real soon.
Thanks, bud.
You got it. All right, it's 4 o'clock now, so we get our top of the hour Sports Center coming our way. And you know what else I'm going to do before, just to kind of lighten it up, since we've had all of this sadness about the Cavaliers. If you're a Cavs fan, anyway, it's sad. And the way this series has gone, I'm going to give you something awesome right now. Did you know Bob Seger is coming to Toledo at the Huntington Center in August? I am a huge Bob Seger fan. I would love to be at the show, but I can't get these tickets. Only you can, because I work for the station, and so therefore I'm ineligible, and that sucks. That means I got five pairs of Beat the Box Office tickets to Bob Seger for you. I'll give the first one away right now to caller number 5 at 866-240-1065. 866-240-1065. Tickets go on sale this Friday at the Huntington Center box office at 10 a.m. and online at livenation.com. Bob Seger in Toledo at the Huntington Center on August 24th. Information is on our website at 1065theticket.com. Caller 5, you've got the first pair. Good luck.
Cavaliers within one. Durant catch and shoot three from the left. Hits it, and he's fouled by J.R. Smith. Kevin Durant a chance at a four-point play. Curry spots up open for three. Straight down, six-point game. And the outlet is stolen, Hubie. They tried to get Kyrie Irving. Three-quarter court down. The other way, it's Curry. Curry against James. Baseline right, cut off by LeBron. Circles in, goes out, has him on skates. Takes James to the rim, and he scores! What a move! Karim goes off to the corner. LeBron let it go, and it's Iguodala coming up with it. Over to Durant, a wide-open triple bricked. Pass is tipped out to Klay Thompson, who reloads a three and hits. How many opportunities will the Warriors get? A long lob batted away by Curry down low defensively. Down court, Durant at the rim. Fouled, and he scored. Curry gets a screen. Passes out left side to Thompson. Barely made it there. Picks it up. Shoots a three and hits. Love outside the mid-post left. Backing down Durant. Now clear space. Blocked by Durant. And his fifth, and he takes it away. Here's Durant crossing over James, driving into Love. Puts it off the window and in as he hits the deck. What a game for Kevin Durant. Kevin Durant dribbling just inside of half court, guarded by LeBron James. West sets a screen, now chasing down. Durant for three, hits it again. James couldn't get there fast enough. He's got 31. Curry on the weak side has the rebound and a triple-double. The first of his postseason career. And he shoots a three, and he hits it. Steph Curry with 30 points. Warriors lead by 22.
Usually you're a podium guy. I mean, in the finals especially, and it's just coming doing this in the locker room, any reason for that?
There is a reason.
You want to share?
No. has nothing to do with wins and losses, though.
LeBron, you just feel it's a case where you guys just need to defend home court at this point?
Are you a smart guy?
I think so. Sure.
I think so, right? So if we don't defend home court, what happens?
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying.
I'm asking you.
Well, yeah, then you guys are looking at getting swept.
All right. That answers your question. They're a different team. You guys asked me what was the difference, and I told you, so they're a different team.
Down 0-2, you know, going back home, you know, you got to live with those odds, and you got to remain non-wavering. As I say, never wavering in terms of whatever the outlook looks like. We go home, we understand who we are, and then we stay the course. As much as the comparison wants to be drawn from last year to this year, this is a totally different team. There is no comparison, even though being down 0-2 again, going back home. So it's a different series, I mean, from our third year that we're playing against one another. You know, going back home, still got to stay the course.
We have to do the little things to withstand their runs that they're gonna make, because they're a very talented team. They have two top-class players in this league. You got to expect them to shoot better just naturally being at home. So we have to do the little things, not turn the ball over and continue to keep them off the offensive glass, do our best job keeping them off the free throw line.
They came on through a nice blow to start the game, getting to the paint, you know, and I think that's one thing we got to cover. I mean, we can't give up 23 points off our turnovers. You know, that's especially a championship team like that. They're going to thrive off of it. But I just think we just stay poised and, you know, try to play better one-on-one defense and, you know, make them shoot over or contest, and they're going to make some. But if we just try to make it tough on them, it'll be in our favor. We know how hard it is to be the best team in the league. So we got to just keep going, man. Keep our foot on the gas and keep getting better every day.
Thinking about thought of where my emotions are, there's a great song that says, sometimes the light shines brightly on me. Other times I can barely see. Lately it's occurred to me what a long, strange trip it's been. Obviously, this has been probably the greatest 13 years of my life. Been incredible. I know how hard the conversation was that we had. Completely understand it. We mutually agreed to do this.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Rolling onward now, 12 minutes after 4 in hour number 2 on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We'll get back to the NBA Finals discussion in just a bit. But first, want to talk about the last thing you just heard in that montage put together by Jim Cushlin. Thad Matta, 13 years at Ohio State, a 337-123 overall record, 20-game winner, 12 consecutive years, 2 Final Fours, 3 Elite Eights, and a Big Ten champion 5 times. He leaves Columbus as Ohio State's all-time winningest basketball coach. He is out in Columbus, and a national search for his successor is on. Joining us now is the great voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes, Paul Keels, just to talk a little bit about Thad Matta and the legacy that he forged while at Ohio State and what the Buckeyes will do going forward. Paul, thanks so much for your time this afternoon. How are you, sir?
I'm good, Bob. How are you doing?
I'm good. I was a little surprised, I have to say. You know, I'm not down in Columbus, so I don't know if this was something that was rumbling for a while after this past season in which the Buckeyes did not make it to the postseason. So can you tell me how long this change was in the works?
It had not been rumbling, Bob. If you remember, during the Big Ten tournament, Gene Smith put out a statement saying that Thad would return as head coach, that they had confidence in what they were doing and how they were doing it. Then I think in the offseason, you've seen, the things that have happened with one of the players who had verbally committed for 2 years from now, withdrawing that commitment, Jaquan Lyle leaving the team, and then subsequently after leaving the team, in which nobody knew what happened, having an arrest. There seemed to be some things that prompted Gene Smith and Thad Matta to have these discussions. And, Gene Smith in the press conference, as well as Thad Matta, put all kind of effort in saying this was a mutual decision. And for those who know Thad Matta, he's the kind of guy that wants to do what's right for everybody involved. So it caught everybody by surprise. There were rumors earlier today that Thad was going to retire after one more season as coach, but this is something that takes effect immediately. And you mentioned all the accomplishments. 9 combined Big Ten titles with regular season and tournament championship. What he did at Ohio State, short of winning a national championship, certainly sets a very, very high stage for whoever comes in to follow.
No question about that. Let's talk just a little bit more about the mutual nature of the parting of ways here. Certainly it can be mutual, but somebody makes the first phone call. It's not something where I would think Thad Matta called Gene Smith and said, I think I want to go. The AD had to call him and say, because of some of the circumstances you just described, we need to talk. So while it may be mutual, it was indeed the school's decision to make this happen.
Well, the way Gene laid the decisions out and the way he's done things with all of his coaches, from what we understand, is there are semi-regular impromptu discussions just about the state of affairs. So I don't know that this was one that it was done because of what happened that they needed to have a discussion. There always seemed to be between Gene and Thad an open stream of communication. And it's important to point out, too, remember, Gene was not the AD who hired Thad Mata. He took over at the tail end of Thad's first season. But the relationship has been a solid one. And the fact that they're going to allow Thad to continue to be involved in the transition, they're going to lean on him for input on candidates. I think that tells you an awful lot about it. This is a situation that is unfortunate in a lot of ways, but you know, those who are around it and those who follow, I think, will have a great understanding and appreciation that Ohio State is very grateful to all of the things that Thad Mata has brought to this university. And Thad himself would be the first one to tell you that, you know, ultimately it has to do with winning basketball games. And in the last 2 years, they didn't win the way that everybody, Thad and the coaches included, would like them to have done.
We are talking with the voice of the Buckeyes, Paul Keels, this afternoon, right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket. Paul, you mentioned recruiting, and Gene did at the press conference. He said that we're not winning the recruiting battles, and that's a big part of it. Recruiting is a major part of it. Why do you think that is? Well, I mean, this is Ohio State. You know, for a long time, you know, it could be assumed, especially during this very successful 13-year run that Thad Mata has been on, Ohio State recruits itself. I mean, goodness gracious, if you're a top-tier basketball player anywhere in the Midwest, and Ohio State comes calling, you'd be automatically, that would be in your top two or three to decide where to go. What's changed? Why was Thad losing some of these top-tier recruits?
I don't know that there's a real good answer to that, Bob. I think if you read between the lines with some of the statements that were made by Thad Mata, not just today, but in other cases, mm-hmm. I think, and we become aware too, that there's a lot of negative recruiting that's going on out there. There, at one point, and I don't know how true this was or not, but mm-hmm. there was supposedly one opposing Big Ten coach that told a recruit who eventually did come to Ohio State, that he shouldn't consider it because they thought Thad Mata was going to die because of his back problem.
Oh, my goodness.
So I think, you know, there's been a little bit of poison in the water. I think if you look at what has happened in the last 13 years, Ohio State certainly has not had any issues with violations with recruiting or things of that nature. There's no question that Thad Mata, you know, outwardly, as much as we know and can tell, has done it the right way and hasn't been willing to relent. Certainly when you lose a whole recruiting class like they did with the one with Jaquan Lyle and Daniel Giddens, that says a lot. But I think if those are individual situations, you can look at guys that maybe weren't doing their part to fill the bill. But ultimately, that falls on the coaches who recruited them, too. So why they're losing some of those recruiting battles, I'm not sure, except to say that, you know, when you get in the NCAA tournament, when you get that kind of a display, that helps your brand and your image a little bit. And unfortunately, Ohio State wasn't able to do that the last couple of years.
That's a great point. Which begs this question then, as far as the marketability of the job. I mean, this still would have to be, right? I mean, a job that anybody would want. This has to be still considered one of the top jobs in the country. So what kind of a coach do you think they're going to be looking for in terms of style, if you will, and then also in terms of a young up-and-comer, do you think? Or, hey, you know what, this is Ohio State University. We want an established, you know, star type of coach.
You know, I think really it's going to be a lot of the things that become cliches with all of that. But most importantly, I think they want to find somebody who's going to do it the right way, that they don't have to be concerned, with anybody maybe going about doing things the way that Ohio State has not been accustomed to, i.e. making sure that the rules are followed and things like that. Somebody who's had a track record of some success. Somebody that, you know, I don't know that there's a limitation on whether it's somebody young, somebody old, somebody more experienced or not. But I think certainly there's not going to be a shortage of names. You know, the names are already being tossed about, people that, you know, all of us can, you know, wax on about who might be a good fit, who might not be a good fit.
Toss a couple of them this way. What names are you hearing that are?
Well, some of the names that you know, and again, just reading the internet sites,
sure.
You're certainly seeing Chris Mack from Xavier as one. Mm-hmm. Chris Holtman from Butler. I know Billy Donovan at Oklahoma City Thunder. His name will get fanned about. I think Greg Marshall's name always comes up with stuff like this. Wouldn't be surprised if Bob Huggins' name gets mentioned because of the success he's had in the state of Ohio.
Sure.
At one point, Bob did covet the Ohio State job when he was at Cincinnati. Those are probably some of the ones that we'll hear.
Is there anybody on Thad's staff that would be considered a possible candidate?
I would say possible, maybe Chris Gent, and then also Dave Dickerson, who was a head coach at Tulane. There might be some cursory discussions about that. Tony Bennett in Virginia might be another name that maybe could get. But that's right now, Bob, that's all a lot of guesswork at this point.
Sure, sure, sure. Understood. Now, I don't know where things are on the calendar here. How soon do you think Gene wants to find somebody to get him in place?
Well, and that was a question that was asked of him in the press conference. And he basically said whatever time it takes to make the right decision. Certainly, you've got to believe, Bob, that athletic directors always have in their mind, if something unforeseen happens, who would be the first people that they would go to. So I'm sure that Gene's been thinking about, you know, how would they go about taking the next step if that needed to be made. So timing, I'm not sure. Remember, Thad was hired in July when he got the job. So, so you know, I guess we can, you know, kind of half-heartedly say there's precedent for late hires. But
yep, yeah,
the timing is not good.
Yeah, no,
the
no,
timing's
it's not.
Not good, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if this was to happen, I'm just really curious again, you know, because you're right. What Gene put out there at the end of the season, and he commented on it too about how everything was going to be good and Thad was coming back, et cetera. You just wonder why, if this was even an inkling in anybody's mind that this could happen, why you didn't do it then, so that you would have this coach in place now and be full, you know, full bore going into the summer and getting ready for next season.
I don't think it was an inkling. I truly, truly believe that all involved felt that, you know, when the season ended, when they were knocked out on the first day of the Big Ten tournament, that they were going to continue to push forward with a guy who was under contract for 3 years and has done all of the things that you talked about. You know, whether it's not getting some of the people that they targeted with graduate transfers or things like that. You know, the situation with Jaquan Lyle, who knows how timely and how much of a factor those were. But it really was a surprise to everybody. It's a shame because having personally dealt with a guy for 13 years, there's not a lot of better people that ever walked the planet than Thad Mata and his family. So it's sad news from that front, from a personal standpoint.
Yeah, too. Absolutely. It really is. You know, there's two different, you know, avenues there. One is the personal side. And as you say, he's a very, very well-respected man, not just as a coach, but as a person. And then there's the basketball side. What are they going to do and who are they going to get and how soon is it going to be done so that the Buckeyes can get that program right back in the direction they wanted to be in? Well, Paul, listen, I know you're busy. I really appreciate you squeezing out a few minutes to talk about Thad today. Obviously, you knew him very well, and you did all of these years of broadcasting for him and talking with him. So we certainly appreciate your perspective, and thanks very much for the time.
My pleasure, Bob. Take care.
You got it. There you go. Paul Keels, voice of the Buckeyes, joining us talking about Thad Mata. I got to admit, I was a little surprised because of the timing. As Paul just said, I mean, you know, this is a late summer thing. Well, it's not late summer yet. July would be late summer, but this is much later than it should be. Buckeye season, of course, ended a couple of months ago, and you would think they would have had this thing done then. And then had the new coach in place. But he said he didn't think there was an inkling that this was going to happen. Everybody was full steam ahead for 2017-18 with Thad Mata on the sidelines. And then, boom, just almost out of nowhere, we agreed mutually that this isn't working right now and it's time for a leadership change. One source, according to ESPN.com, said that Mata wanted to keep coaching. At the news conference today, he said never say never to the possibility of him returning to the sideline. But he does also say he wants to try to get healthy. That's one of the reasons for, you know, his part of the mutual decision on leaving the job is he has to get healthy. He's been battling health issues for a long time in Columbus, including back surgery in 2007. And wow, Jim Cushlin, Frank Argano, I didn't know that kind of negative recruiting was going on. We all know that there is negative recruiting. And we all know that there are coaches, excuse me, that'll tell recruits a lot of bad stuff about a lot of programs in order to get them to come to their school.
Right.
But to say that the guys might die, you know, that his back injury is so severe that it might be life-threatening, if that's true, and we don't know if it's true, but it's something that's been bandied about. My goodness gracious, no wonder, you know, if that was happening, it probably did have an impact on the recruiting.
Yeah, it could very well, if indeed something like that was happening. But, you know, back to your original thought, the kind of a little bit of surprise that just kind of out of the blue. I remember hearing late this morning the report came out, oh, there's going to be a press conference involving Gene Smith and Thad Mata later on this afternoon. And I'm thinking to myself,
it's not a contract extension.
Yeah, it certainly isn't. He had 1 year, I think, left on his deal. Originally,
yes.
So that's where he was going to come back comes from. But sadly, doesn't it go, it almost sort of proves that old sports kind of thing, when somebody gives you that vote of confidence, even if it's not tomorrow, it's usually the death nail. I keep thinking now back to that midpoint in March when they were bounced in that first game of the Big Ten tournament. Then, what did we immediately hear? We're sticking with that, you know, yada, yada, yada. And I always thought in the back of my head, would not surprise me if by the end of the summer there's a presser that they're moving on. Because it always seems to happen that way, doesn't it? And, you get the public vote of confidence, and eventually you're gone.
Yeah, I mean, it happens far more than people realize. I mean, sometimes it doesn't.
Sometimes you're right. It's not universal.
It's one of those Sports Illustrated things, where if somebody is featured on the cover, or even the Madden curse now, if somebody's featured on the cover of the Madden thing and then they have a bad year, they get an injury or something like that, it's cursed. But then they'll ignore the 9 years in a row when whoever was on the cover did fine, you know? So every time somebody gives the proverbial public vote of confidence, and then somebody, you know, gets canned.
Yeah.
See, that's how. But if they don't, nobody even notices it because it was just like they said, he was going to be here and he is here. And so it's not a newsworthy item. So that's how those things go. I am a little surprised, like I said, that it happened at this particular time, this particular juncture. But I understand if the recruiting class is subpar because, for whatever reason, if it be negative recruiting or things that Ohio State isn't quite doing the same way maybe as they did 12 years ago with that. Then you've got to stock the cupboard with plenty of talented players, and if they're not there, they're not there.
And it's clear to me now, you know, even more so than it was early March, that this is clearly a woe point right now for Ohio State basketball. And whether it was Thad Matta next season or someone else, it's going to take a year or two to get the program back up to where a lot of Buckeye fans think it should be. I mean, after all, this past season was technically the worst of Thad Matta's entire tenure. And even I was speculating at the time that I won't even, say 1 year, but 2 years from now, they better be blatantly challenging for tournament spots again. But that was assuming it would be Thad Matta, so I don't know what the new timeline is, but I do know one stat number that going forward is going to be kind of where a lot of the struggles will be centered around. I want to say I read today, they can have 13 scholarships. They only have 9 right now. That, to me, kind of says it all right there, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. That does. Go ahead, Frank.
No, it's weird that it came this late. My question is, do they know coming off that Big Ten tournament that there's a problem?
Given the Gene Smith comment.
I know. Did he get the benefit of the doubt because he, what Paul Keel say, 5 Big Ten titles?
Well, yeah. 9 combined, 5 regular season and 4 tournament champions.
Right.
Right, but I don't know. Usually when there's that big of a change that needs to be done from somebody with that stature, I'm really surprised this didn't come earlier because a new coach, with college, it's everything. A new coach, new recruiting system, new culture, new everything. I'm just really shocked that this came this late.
Yeah.
Because it hurts recruiting. That's going to be the biggest thing.
That's the biggest thing of
recruiting college sports. Guys. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so obviously a bit of a strange story coming out of Columbus there. Not strange, but just maybe a little bit surprising, as Thad Matta is indeed out as the Buckeyes basketball coach, and they are now searching for a new one. Some interesting names there that Paul Keels just threw out, by the way. But, as he pointed out, these are just internet rumors. Bob Huggins and Billy Donovan, who, of course, is such a great coach at Florida, and now at Oklahoma City, maybe he wants to come back to the college game rather than coach Russell Westbrook in that situation. I mean, Lord knows, there's a lot of names out there, so we'll have to follow that. Speaking of college coaching, by the way, if I told you that there was a movie being made about the Penn State child abuse scandal involving Jerry Sandusky, and starring a certain Hollywood actor as Joe Paterno, who do you think they would cast as Joe Paterno, Frank Argano?
Joe Paterno?
Yeah.
Oof. De Niro, Joe Pesci?
Close. And I said think big, and you're in the ballpark.
What's his name? Ray Liotta?
No, it's not Ray Liotta. Kush? God.
Those would actually, a couple of those would have actually been my guesses.
I was going to say, those are solid guesses.
You're skipping like the most obvious one, and it's right in the same ballpark. They were in some of the same movies together. Oh my goodness, I'm disappointed in you guys. HBO has greenlit and will move forward with a new movie on the Penn State football scandal with Al Pacino playing former head coach Joe Paterno.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Pacino, okay. Paterno. I mean, and you know what? I'm looking at some of the pictures. I can totally see this working.
Interesting.
And I'm very interested in the movie. but I'm also going to be completely disgusted by it.
I was going to say, it's just going to anger me.
It's going to anger me.
I'm just going to be pissed.
In a number of ways. Number one, they're going to kind of give us whatever visual depictions they need to help us understand what, you know, was alleged, and not alleged, what was proven in the trial of Jerry Sandusky.
Yeah.
But by way of testimony, you know, guys like Mike McQuarrie is going to have to, you know, in real life, he had to describe what he experienced when he walked into that coach's shower that day. He's going to have to describe that, and while clearly they won't show that on screen, the moment is going to be there. They're going to have to tell people who don't know the story, who didn't watch the nonstop coverage of it, you know, during that period of time. And what year was it now? 2011, I want to say?
I think 2011.
6 years ago now. It's hard to believe. 6 years ago. 7 years ago. No, 6 years ago. Anyway, you know, for people who didn't watch it or people who were too young then to know what's going on, who is this guy, Joe Paterno, winning his coach of all time, blah, blah, blah. They're going to have to tell the story. And part of telling the story is going to be the crimes. And then, of course, the cover-up of the crimes, or in the Joe Paterno case, the I don't want to know anything about this. I called my boss, and that's it. I ejected myself from the conversation and the situation, and all of the stuff that made so many people, myself included, lose all of the respect that I had for Jopa for so many years. I mean, for decades, he forged his reputation as being such a squeaky, clean, you know, coach. I mean, this was Penn State. This was the opposite of Jimmy Johnson in Miami. You know, this is where you don't go to self-glorify, and this is where you don't go to commit crimes, and this is where you don't go to school and FSU for a free shoes university under Bobby Bowden, right? This is Penn State and Joe Paterno. And for this to happen under his watch with his defensive coordinator and his decades-long friend, Jerry Sandusky, and for him to, and just, I don't want to litigate the whole thing now, but just very, very briefly remind people of why he was fired. Because he was told by Mike McQuarrie what went on. He called his boss and then washed his hands of the whole thing. Meanwhile, Jerry Sandusky still has access to the camps, still has access to the kids, still has access to the shower rooms and the entire Penn State program. Instead of getting rid of him immediately, he allowed things to continue. Even if he didn't know they were actually continuing, he allowed the circumstances to present themselves so that this could go on. And it's that ultimately took down Joe Paterno. That lack of action and lack of follow-up. I mean, you would just think that after that one phone call, that there might be another one the next day or the next day and the next day saying, what are you guys doing? What are you guys doing? What did you find out? Did you talk to Jerry? Where are we? Blah, blah, blah. I need to know. And, you know, should I ban this guy from the program? Should I kick him out of the facilities? What should I do? Talk to me here. And according to virtually all of the research done and the investigations that were done, Jopa didn't do that. He didn't want to know. And that's why, and you know, there are certain members of the Penn State hierarchy that literally just, what, 2 days ago, 3 days ago, maybe it was on Friday, did you see that, were sentenced to jail, sentenced to a prison time for their roles in this. Wasn't it just a couple of days ago?
Yeah, it was like Friday or something.
Yeah, yeah. They just had, I think it was on Friday, they just had the latest individual sentenced to prison. I'll tell you what, let me get my break here at the bottom of the hour since it's 4:33. We'll get our Sports Center break here. By the way, congratulations to John. Help me out, guys. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh,
you talked to him. How do you say that last name?
Oh, it was Trev. I can't even do it right now.
Oh, my gosh.
I know.
Are you kidding me? Van Steenjesty. There you go. Van Steenjesty. God bless you, John. And you know what? God bless you for learning how to spell that at a young age. That must have taken you a lot longer time than the rest of the kids to put your name on your paper. John Van Steenjesty has been listening and was caller number 5. And of Gross Isle and going to see Bob Seger in August at Huntington Center. We've got more tickets for that Beat the Box Office prize. Opportunity for you coming up tomorrow and Wednesday and Thursday as well. So congratulations to John. And let me remind you now as well about another chance you can you have to win a great prize. You want to see want tickets to see each event at the Michigan International Speedway the week of June 16th. That's not this coming weekend, but the next one. To qualify, send a text and send MIS for Michigan International Speedway, MIS ticket to the short code 64636. Send that to us there, and you could win tickets to each event the weekend of June 16th at Michigan International Speedway from your friends at ESPN 106.5, the ticket. All right, we'll kind of update that Penn State story a little bit, come back to the NBA Finals as well, and maybe even a baseball thought or two before we're done at 5 o'clock right here on ESPN 106.5.
By calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 106.5, the ticket.
Yes, indeed. We do indeed continue now at 4:42. We've got 18 minutes of outstanding awesome left for you. Then we're going to turn it over to Mike Miller and Drive Time. I want to talk more in a moment about Jeff Van Gundy. I talked about this with our friend Dennis Mandeloff in the 3 o'clock hour, 3:30 portion of the show. Jeff Van Gundy said that Steph Curry and Kevin Durant, as they played in games 1 and 2 of the NBA Finals thus far, maybe one of the greatest duos ever of all time to play together. I think that's a little bit extreme and a little bit premature, but that's what he said.
One of the best duos to play together, maybe ever. Kevin Durant coming off the pick and roll. That's just unguardable. And Steph Curry. Yeah, I said it. The best to play ever together.
I mean, really one of the worst examples of prisoner of the moment I think you'll ever see. I mean, they're playing great tonight. Watch them. Oh, my God. Durant just hit a three over five people. Oh, my God. Curry just made people look stupid. Then he pulled up from 30 and hit one. Oh, and they fed the other one. And it's like, oh, my God, have you ever seen two guys play better than this together before? Stop, Jeff. Stop. That's prisoner of the moment. They're great, yes. They're both former MVPs. That's special. Scoring champions and on down the line. About to be NBA champions together. But come on, let's take a step back here. Let's slow your roll a little bit and start talking about the best duos ever to play together. Let's go first, though, to Ryan, who's calling us from Fostoria. He wants to stay on the NBA as a topic, so let's do that. Ryan, thanks for joining us. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I just want to comment a couple different things about the finals. First of all, I don't think that double dribble by Steph Curry.
Yes.
He'd have never got that shot off if it wasn't for that double dribble.
You're right.
LeBron sold out for that shot.
Yes, he did. When he put both hands on the ball, it looked like he was going to shoot that three, and that's why LeBron went up. You know, he was like going to challenge it, and then he went right back down and went under him and then went in and scored. It was a double dribble, and I haven't heard anybody talk about it, really. At least last night on the broadcast, nobody ever mentioned it.
Well, I mean, how long did he dribble before before that actually happened? I mean, LeBron had him shut down outside the arc. He had nowhere to go.
I would not say that. I would not say that. He didn't know. I mean, I think he was toying with LeBron a little bit there because it was about 7 or 8 seconds of dribbling. And he went in and he went out and LeBron was with him. And I think he was just trying to decide which way am I going to attack him from. And obviously when he did the little up fake there and then went under, he made the mistake of putting the second hand on the ball. But he didn't need to do that for that play to have worked. Once he raised that head up a little bit and squared his shoulders like I'm going to shoot this one and got LeBron up, all they had to do was go by him, which he did. Now, he did right. Put both hands on the ball, but I didn't think LeBron had him shut down as much as I saw him kind of doing what Kyrie has done with many, many people, and that is just put on a dribbling exhibition to decide which way I'm going to take this guy.
Sure. Now, as far as KD goes, and you made mention of, you know, he can't ride coattails, I would say game one, he absolutely, without question, dominated. But as far as game two, I think in the first half, the Cavs looked like a completely different team. They were multiple hands in his face, shutting him down. And it wasn't until Golden State three-point shooters started getting hot that I don't think he started accumulating most of his points.
I'm going to probably disagree with you on that one as well, too. I think at halftime he had 15 of his 33. And overall, it's not just the points when I say that he dominated and he's leading the way. It's 33 points. And it's 13 rebounds, and it's, I want to say, 6 assists now. I got to find the box score again and pull it up here. Here it is. He had 33 points. He had 13 rebounds, 6 assists, 3 steals, and 5 blocks, which is incredible. And he blocked
yeah.
Kevin Love, and he blocked LeBron, and he's controlling the paint defensively for that team. He shot 13 of 22, so that's, what, 54% from the floor. I mean, honestly, I mean, he's been about as dominant as a player can be. I mean, and it's LeBron-type dominance from last year's finals, I think.
Sure. I'm just saying I think that it helps out when you've got those knockdown shooters. That terrible game that LeBron had against Boston, the next game,
yeah.
He was struggling in the beginning until Kyrie got hot, which opens him up.
I just think it has a lot of the same effect. Now, I'm not saying, now where you and I can agree is that I do believe that Cleveland's team is just, for the most part, a high percentage of the team is just been non-existent so far. That being, I mean, is Golden State a good team? That's probably about as ignorant of a question as that reporter had from LeBron.
Yeah, of course.
But I don't know. I mean,
let me say this. Let me say this to support your point. When Curry got hot, did it help Durant then? Absolutely. But vice versa. They feed off of each other. And I think Durant got hot first. Remember, Curry started the night 1-for-6 from three.
Sure.
And Curry finished 4-for-11 from three. Durant made 4 out of 8. He was 50%. I think Durant's ability to score inside and out and in transition and over people, he makes threes where it just looks like, well, that's not going in because somebody is right in his face as he falls away. He's got such a great fall away. And then it's net. And it's like, Jesus, criminy. He really is a special type of scoring talent. And I could just as well argue if we watched it together again with a beer in our hands or something, I could just as well probably argue that Durant kind of caught fire and got things going, which opened it up for Curry to get hot after he started out cold as ice, 1-for-6 from three, then the other way around.
I suppose I can see what you're saying. I guess I'm looking at it through biased eyes. I'm just hoping I don't have to get the broom out now.
Yeah, you and me both. And, you know, the real thing you and I, neither one of us have talked about here, but that I talked about Friday, is Clay. We saw that Thompson, you know, couldn't hit the broadside of a barn in game one and really threw most of the Western Conference Finals against the Spurs, too. And, you know, when he gets hot, I mean, there's just a defense.
There's too many weapons.
Yeah, a defense can only stretch itself so many places. And when you've got such a great three-point pure shooter as Curry and another one in Thompson and another one in Durant, for God's sake, I mean, it's just too much weaponry to try to even to have a really great defensive team locked down, and the Cavaliers are not a great defensive team in the first place.
Couldn't agree more.
Yeah. All right, my friend. Thank you, Ryan. God bless. Appreciate the call. So, yeah, Clay had 8 out of 12. That's 75% shooting if you're scoring at home. And 4-for-7 from 3 and scored 22 points, which is kind of how his season went. He was a 22.5-point-per-game scorer behind Curry and Durant. And Durant, I think, here's the thing. As much of a punk move as I will continue to call it, that Durant made by going to the Warriors and glomming on, as I've said many times, to an already championship caliber team. As much as I'll continue to say that, I'm also being realistic when I'm watching it play out before my eyes. And I think I can tell you that without Kevin Durant, the Cavaliers win last night. Curry could have still gone off for his 32, and Clay could have had his 22. And I think the Cavaliers win last night. Kevin Durant didn't just score 33. He took 10 points away from the Cavaliers by blocking 5 of their point-blank shots.
Mm-hmm.
That's 43.
Not to mention at one point when it was a one-point game early stages of the third, yep. What does he do? Crazy four-point play, and
yeah,
they never
the
look back.
Four-point play.
And they never looked back from that, really. That
and then
was
later
the closest
on, it
the Cavs
was late
got.
In the third, I think, guys, when he blocked Kevin Love's shot on the defensive end and ran down the floor and took the first pass back as he attacked from the right side of the lane and fell backwards. And I don't know if he got fouled or not. And made a shot.
And he made that, and he was fouled, too. So that was a three-point play as well.
It was, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, defensive end to offensive. I mean, he's playing like a man possessed. See, here's the thing for me. I hate this because, as I've said many times through the years on the radio, including the 2+ years that we've been doing this, Kevin Durant has been one of my favorite players.
Mm-hmm.
I love Kevin Durant, and it's for this reason, what we're seeing right now. It's just that he did it for a team that I didn't hate before. And he did it on his own team before, and so I just respected it and loved it, and I often challenged, is LeBron James really the best player on the planet? Watch this game by Kevin Durant. I mean, can LeBron do all of these things? Blah, blah, blah. And then LeBron will do spectacular things, and I'll have to say, okay, Kevin Durant's the second best player on the planet. And that's fine. But what you're seeing in these first two games is what made me love him as a player. And, of course, I respected him as a man because of his whole, and we've talked about this too.
Right, yeah.
the way he carries himself and the respect he showed to his mother when he won the MVP and made his speech and all that sort of thing. So it's weird. I'm watching him, and I want to be able to appreciate what I'm seeing last night. Some of the shots he was able to make. Some of the passes he was able to make. Some of the block shots. And just the grace of a seven-footer who can run like a guard, shoot like a point guard like Curry, finish at the rim like a power forward like LeBron. Well, LeBron is a small forward, but he's so powerful. But you know what I mean? I mean, can just do it all, and I want to be able to say, wow. And part of me, I catch myself saying, oh, my God, wow. But then the other part of me is like, God dang it, I hate you. Because he shouldn't be there. He shouldn't be there. He should have stayed where he was and said, I'm going to try to beat the Warriors. But he didn't stay there. He went to the Warriors, and now he has made the Warriors his. He didn't glom on. He isn't riding in a passenger seat on a championship bus that was already going to the championship. He's driving it. And without him, I'm not sure that the same thing that happened last year doesn't happen again this year, where the Cavaliers beat them in seven games. Because I think absent Durant, the healthy LeBron, Kyrie, Kevin Love threesome, along with the supporting parts, is probably as good as the Curry, Thompson, Harrison Barnes, Draymond, Pachulia, David West group. I feel good that I think we can do that. It's Kevin Durant that is the difference maker, and he's the leader. It's Kevin. It may be Steph Curry's franchise because he's been there longer, but right now, this season and this series, this is Kevin Durant's team.
Mm-hmm.
It might be Curry's franchise, but it's Durant's team because he is setting the pace all the way through at both ends of the floor, and he's going to be the MVP of this series if he has a couple more just like this one.
And you know, that combined with Paul Pierce's comments, I mean, you played the Jeff Van Gundy ones, but I don't mind those as much, honestly, especially when I think of what Paul Pierce said last night, which is, no, Kevin Durant is the best player, you know, in the world. Not only do I obviously disagree with that, but a combination of what you're saying and then thinking of that means at some point, we've all gone out on the Durant portion of that whole argument for the last year, right? But at the same time, I think it could be somewhat safely said that, you know, Golden State on the other side, hey, they had the financial flexibility to be able to do this, so they did.
Because
but why
of the new
did they do this?
Because
they
of the new cap space created by the new contract,
exactly.
The TV contract.
But we never essentially say anything from the Golden State part of you that, yes, though they were, because of cap things and all that, they were actually able to do this. But why did they do it? Because they still have to beat LeBron.
Right.
This is why, I'm sorry, Paul Pierce is just way the heck off on his comment last night. Because
what did he say specifically?
He basically said that he thinks Kevin Durant is the best player on the planet right now.
Paul Pierce doesn't like LeBron, never has.
Right.
You know that. They
of
have
course.
A rivalry on the court as well.
Yes.
So that's probably a little bit of just, you know, personal animosity going in. But I can also say this. As LeBron turns a year older next year, LeBron and Kevin Durant, he'll be 33. Kevin Durant will only be 29. And Kevin Durant now playing with the freedom that playing with Golden State allows him to have, meaning he isn't always necessarily going to be double-teamed or triple-teamed the way a star of his caliber would be because of the presence of the other guys, means that he could very well start to do some things on the court that make people say legitimately what Pierce said, and that he has finally taken that mantle away from LeBron James. He's the best player on the planet, and it's something he'll hold on to for 3 or 4 or 5 years till he's 33 or 4, and somebody younger comes up behind him and takes that.
I guess the point I'm trying to... I don't discount the possibility of that happening. I guess what I'm saying is it shows that LeBron is still the best because that's what Golden State had to do to make sure they could get past LeBron.
Right, right.
And we've never really talked about it from that
angle
in the past year.
The real question is, which we didn't talk about today because we're out of time and we're going to have to talk about tomorrow, is what is the counter move? After there is a sweep here, and it probably will be, or Warriors in five, what is the counter move for David Griffin and for Dan Gilbert? What can they possibly do to say, you know, all we're going to do next year is win the East again and go back up against this same juggernaut that is still young?
Yep.
The oldest guy in that group is 29.
Right.
And I think that's Curry.
Yeah.
You know, so they're still young, and they're going to do this for 3 or 4 more years.
I'm not sure what the answer to that is, and we will have more time for this tomorrow. Suffice it to say,
there is no Kevin Durant that's going to be in free agency that you could bring aboard to say, okay, we countered yours with our
own.
Then
a star is going to have to be traded, and I don't like those options either.
No, I don't either. I do have some ideas. I don't know how you make them work under the cap, but I do have some names, and I'll float to you tomorrow, and we'll talk about it then. That's all the time we have. Drive Time coming your way next with Mike Miller. Stay where you are. We'll talk to you tomorrow right here on the Extravaganza. Bye-bye.